Democrats are praising President Obama's decision to reject the Keystone XL pipeline project, calling it a victory for the environment. However, Republicans are saying they are not giving up, calling the plans an economic boon. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, November 10th. We will welcome in a guest environmental policy expert to take a look at President Obama's announcement and the reactions that followed. Later in the hour, we will also get an update from Wisconsin Public Radio's environmental reporter, Chuck Quirnbach, on the cleanup of two trains, one of which was carrying crude oil, that derailed in Wisconsin over the weekend. And we will welcome your questions and your views on this. Do you think that rejecting the Keystone Pipeline was the right or wrong decision? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Barry Rabe. He is a professor in the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy and director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. He's also a visiting scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. His areas of interest include public and environmental policy. And he graduated from Carthage College in Kenosha and was a visiting professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. So good morning and welcome back to Wisconsin via the radio.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
So what stuck out to you most about President Obama's rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline?
Clearly, this is a step that has been anticipated for some time. But it has also been timed probably to the decision to run up the American position going into the upcoming Paris climate meetings. There's a long, long review process in the U.S. on this. This became a very controversial issue in the U.S., but also in Canada, where the issues were somewhat different. Now what this does is probably puts a halt to the Keystone development, but there was really some uncertainty as to just how far the pipeline would move, even had the president approved it, given the collapse in the price of oil and the very, very high price, the cost to extract that oil from the tar sands of the oil sands in Alberta. It wasn't clear that that pipeline would actually even ever be built, at least under current market conditions. And as was noted in the intro to your show, there is this question of whether the Keystone could come back, possibly under a future presidency or under different circumstances. So it seems like the door is closed to this, but I'm not sure that we've heard the last of this one.
Okay, we'll get more into that. But the president said on Friday that the project was neither a silver bullet for the economy nor the express lane to climate disaster. Do you agree or disagree with the president that Keystone wouldn't have had a dramatic effect one way or the other?
I think that it's fair to say, despite the tremendous attention focused on Keystone out of all the other energy and environmental policy issues currently in the U.S. and internationally, this has gotten a lot of attention. But the overall impact or consequences environmentally probably would have been fairly limited, certainly from a climate perspective. And that's in part because the U.S. is producing so much oil and gas on its own, some of which obviously has become an issue in Wisconsin with the recent train derailments.
Mm-hmm.
We are in a very different position now in the U.S. in terms of how we think about energy than we were when the first conversations on Keystone began almost 10 years ago. So I think in that sense, that it's right. This is not necessarily the dramatic game changer. And again, the longer-term consequences of this may not be as great as might be expected, just given the sheer amount of attention that came to this issue.
And I do want to get to those train derailments and the future of oil transportation. But first, House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin called Obama's decision not surprising but sickening, and said that Obama is rejecting tens of thousands of jobs. What do you make of Ryan's assessment?
There have been numerous economic assessments of what the job impacts would be for pipeline development. And whatever one thinks of the merit of the case, it's not clear at all that this would have much in the way of a long-term jobs effect. There would be construction jobs certainly all along the area of pipeline running through the Dakotas into Nebraska and then farther south. But long-term, probably not much of an effect. And, of course, interestingly, in both Canada and the U.S., there's expanding discussion of how to move these energy supplies, whether they're coming from Alberta or anywhere else, which means rail, possibly expanded rail, possibly expanded pipeline. So in a sense, the development investment may move somewhere else, but I don't think there are any economists who've argued that the job consequences from this one are severe, at least the longer-term ones after the initial construction process.
Bill McKibben, meanwhile, one of the founders of the climate change organization 350.org, wrote an opinion piece in USA Today saying that the fight against Keystone has kept 800,000 barrels a day of the dirtiest oil on earth underground. You're very familiar with Canadian oil operations. What is the oil like that would have been flowing through that pipeline?
This is a somewhat unique kind of oil. It has a very thick composition to it, and so it requires tremendous amounts of energy to extract the oil that would be used. So it's a very energy-intensive operation, and also an expensive one, just simply given the location. This is in the northern corners of Alberta, so far removed from major population centers, either in Canada or the U.S. So it's a lot of money to get it out of the ground, a lot of energy to get it out of the ground. It's a province that produces a lot of oil anyway. Some have referred to Alberta as the Texas of Canada, with the oil sands only being one component of it. Obviously, this oil source was a lot more attractive from a marketing perspective 10 or 15 years ago, when we really were assuming in the U.S. we were kind of phasing out oil and gas development before the fracking boom began all around the United, in many parts of the United States. So there is a really substantial change there. What's not really fully clear is just how dirty, how many more environmental problems or how much more energy has to be put into the extraction process in Alberta with the oil sands, as in some of the other areas where we're pursuing fracking in the U.S., particularly in North Dakota, where there's a lot of energy and efficiency in that operation. If you kind of put them side by side, the oil sands are probably more demanding in terms of their environmental impact, but not markedly different than what we're producing in again, the Dakotas or the Bakken region, for example.
Yeah. We talk about the impact on the environment when it comes to climate change with the Keystone Project, but what about environmental concerns that leaking this, dirty oil was an environmental disaster in the making?
Do you mean the oil?
Yeah, like should the Keystone leak?
As we're seeing pipelines and transmission systems that we have, rail or pipeline, are challenging. Nothing is perfect. It's not clear that leaks from the oil sands would have been that different had a leak occurred than from traditional crude. And what we're beginning to see, and again, you've seen this now in Wisconsin, is that as we rely more and more on different transmission systems, there are dangers of leaks and accidents in my current home state of Michigan. We've had a major oil spill with a pipeline leak in the western part of the state a couple of years ago that's taken years and millions of dollars to clean up. So this is an issue, I would say, not just for energy coming from Alberta and the oil sands, but more broadly, as we remain a country pretty heavily dependent on oil and increasingly natural gas, how do we move that from the point of extraction, wherever that is, to the point where it's going to be consumed, and especially in these cases where there's a substantial distance and a lot of terrain to cover to get it to customers who want to use it, and particularly at a point where oil and gas prices are cheaper and demand for this kind of energy is up pretty dramatically in the last year or so.
Yeah. We have a lot more to talk about after the news, but we have just a minute before news. I mean, what is safer for transporting oil, trains or pipelines?
It's a great question. There's not an easy answer to it. There's no one obvious, proven, reliable system. I think the bulk of evidence would suggest a well-designed pipeline, all things else being equal, is going to be safer than either truck or train. probably a little less risk of a, not only the derailment, but then the large kind of explosion, which we're also increasingly worried about, given some events that have taken place in recent years, and the fact that in many cases these trains are going right through large metropolitan areas, and they're carrying a lot of very highly combustive fuel, especially some of the ones that are coming from the Central Plains region. So there's not an easy solution to this other than, frankly, consuming less energy and reducing demand for the product, and hence less need for the transmission. But it's a very difficult question. Neither is foolproof, or at least neither has yet proven foolproof, although there's thought to be a slight edge to pipelines if you can get political support to do that.
We are talking with Barry Rabe, a professor in the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy. He is the director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, talking with us about President Obama's rejection of the Keystone Pipeline and what that means. And welcoming your questions and your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. First, the news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about President Obama's decision to reject the Keystone XL pipeline project. And we're welcoming your questions and views for our guest expert at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Barry Rabe is a professor at the University of Michigan. He is the director of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. His area of interest includes public and environmental policy. And we have lots of callers, so let's go to the phone. Scott in Elkhorn is with us. Hello, Scott. Scott, are you there? Well, I guess Scott's not there. he thought that that there was no reason to turn down this pipeline or to reject this project, saying it's all political and nothing more. Your response to that?
There are clearly political considerations in this one, the United States and in Canada. I do think the question that emerges is the benefit that would have been derived from this if it went forward. Again, with what we are seeing currently in the oil markets, there just is not demand in the United States to import lots more oil, which is going to come at a higher price from that which we're already producing. As those market factors begin to shift and change, that becomes another factor. But to some extent, this is a pipeline that would actually have to be subsidized by different governments and would also prove to be pretty controversial in places like Nebraska. There was a separate parallel process to review this in Nebraska with some disquiet about how that would work. So clearly political factors and considerations. I think also clearly just because this decision is made should not be seen to end the discussion on pipelines or even Keystone possibly coming back down the road, either under a different president or if we indeed go back to a different situation in our oil production and demand.
Before President Obama made the rejection official, TransCanada asked the State Department to pause its review of Keystone, a move that many said was an attempt to perhaps postpone the decision until after Obama left office. What was going on there?
And I think that's the clearly political part. This was reviewed by the State Department for 6 or 7 years. It seemed increasingly likely that the president was going to reject it. TransCanada is a kind of public-private firm in Canada that was advocating for the pipeline. And when they were reading the tea leaves and seeing that there was a strong likelihood that this was going to be rejected by the president, but also probably delayed even farther in the Nebraska review, this parallel review that I mentioned, they actually suggested that they would withdraw the proposal, table it, if you would, but then come back to it. Very quickly after that, the president and the secretary of state, Mr. Kerry, began to say, no, we are going now to make a decision on that. And this does overlap pretty closely with the run-up to the Paris agreements or negotiations over international climate change. And I think it's fairly safe to say what the president was trying to do with this and some other announcements, one of which is going to be made by Secretary Kerry today in Virginia, I believe, are all things kind of leading up to that. So in a sense, Keystone became a tool to get the president where he wanted to be going into Paris, and clearly strong political aspects of that. Again, though, that doesn't mean that a future leadership of TransCanada or a future president or a series of states could revisit this, but it does put the formal stamp on it by the president after this very, very long review process.
After the State Department denied the request, TransCanada responded by asking whether Americans want to keep importing millions of barrels of oil each day from the Middle East and Venezuela or get it from North Dakota and Canada via the Keystone Pipeline. What do you make of where the U.S. gets its oil from now and where it could be getting it from in the future?
Well, and of course, that has really changed even over the course of the discussion of Keystone. Not only North Dakota, but places all around the United States, actually even Michigan, are producing more oil than ever before. Michigan not being a major oil producer, but a lot of states have moved into the oil and gas production arena through the expansion of so-called fracking technologies and horizontal drillings. It's a remarkable transition and turnaround, and is a huge reason why we're paying, in some cases, $2 or even less a gallon of gasoline now, as opposed to $3, $4, or $5, which was projected where we were going to be at this point without those sources. So that means we are producing more. The amount that we need to import from Venezuela or Canada or anywhere else is really beginning to decline. And also under some consideration in Congress is the idea of allowing the United States to export oil and gas in ways that we have not historically. We have pretty open trade borders with the United States and Canada, but not beyond that in the last 30 or 40 years. And we're revisiting all of that. You know, we will probably never be energy independent in terms of not having any trade go back and forth. But again, it's a somewhat changed position. And I think clearly that reduces the extent to which the U.S. would be relying on Alberta oil sands or crude any time in the near future. One other piece, if I might add, that changes also is that Canada had a major election just 2 weeks ago and a major shift in power there. In the leadership of Canada, and a new election in Alberta where all the energy issues and questions that you can imagine are under close study, including the question of how Canada repositions itself vis-a-vis the U.S. and how it emphasizes oil and gas versus the many other energy options that they have in Canada. So it's a very interesting time, not just south of the border, but within Canada itself where these projects are going to go.
Dave on Facebook shared a Financial Post article saying that the United States has built the equivalent of 10 Keystone pipelines since 2010, including in Wisconsin, where the Enbridge pipeline network already exceeds one Keystone's worth of capacity. Dave suggests that environmentalists have been looking at the wrong things by focusing on Keystone. Is he right?
There's no question that there is a massive infrastructure of pipelines being considered. There's also, the only amendment I would make to that is that there's a massive set of pipelines that are already there, including one that goes through the Straits of Mackinac, which is no small issue, I can assure you, in the state of Michigan and the neighboring provinces of Canada. These are significant concerns. We've been shipping oil and gas underground for a long time. We've been moving it via train for a long time. But for an extended period, at least 20 years or so, the expectation was the U.S. was kind of phasing out of its own development. And we didn't invest much either in retrofitting and upgrading established pipelines or building new ones. That changes not only as we produce more oil and gas, but produce it not just from a few major drilling operations, but lots and lots of small decentralized operations. That's what changes when you move to a fracking mechanism to produce oil and gas. It spreads it out. That means to get that energy and oil that we all want access to and we all want at low prices, you need ability to move it around. And there you kind of pick your poison, if you will, and decide which route. And it's certainly one of the reasons why, again, we're talking either about new pipelines or in some cases going back to existing ones and either expanding them or making sure that they're safe. It's a big, big infrastructure issue that we really haven't talked about a whole lot in the country.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if you probably are not intimately familiar with this Enbridge pipeline in Wisconsin, but the proposal is to double this already high-capacity pipe in Wisconsin carrying oil.
Yes, Enbridge is a very active firm, active regionally, active nationally, major player in most of many of the Great Lakes region states, to be sure. A common proposal has been, not just in Wisconsin, but to go to existing pipelines, either expand them in cases where there's already right-of-way, or literally begin to lay new piping. So I don't know the particulars of the Wisconsin proposal, but this is the sort of discussion we are seeing. You know, if you shut down the pipelines, you basically go to then other questions like more trains, even trucking, although trucking is really risky and really raises many cost kinds of questions, or using other kinds of energy sources. So it's a difficult issue, and I do tend to think when we begin to talk about an infrastructure challenge or crisis in the United States, we're probably talking not just about highways, roads, and bridges, the more common issue, which is a big issue, but we're also talking about how we're going to move energy for the next decade or generation or more.
Let's go to Tom in West Allis now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I'm really glad that the discussion is starting to include the shipment of this oil by rail, because this is an area that I've been kind of researching on my own for at least 2 years. I used to live out in Waukesha County near the Sussex area, and I was just a stone's throw away from some railroad tracks. And going back about 2 years ago, we noticed a substantial increase in rail traffic. And to the point where one time I tracked 16 trains in a 24-hour period. And so I started wondering, well, who owns these railroad tracks? And I did some Googling, come to find out it's Canadian National Railroad. And so then I Googled and I said, well, I wonder where their rail lines all go. And I pulled up a map of Canadian National Railroad, and their lines go basically north and south, right through Wisconsin and Illinois, clear on down to the Gulf of Mexico. And then when you get up into Canada, they make a left turn and they go right out to the oil fields. And I thought, oh my God, this is what they're doing. They're shipping oil. And sure enough, I sat by the tracks one time and saw these super trains coming through with probably more than 100 oil tanker cars. And so I think President Obama's decision is a good thing, but I don't think it goes far enough. We just need an all-out moratorium on shipping this oil by rail.
All right. What about that, Professor Rabe?
Well, thank you for your comment, Tom, and you're quite right. The amount of rail traffic related to oil has increased across North America in the last decade. You mentioned Canadian National. They're a very, very large player within Canada, but within the continent. There are, you know, there are other forces and factors there. And there's no question, you know, I visited a major freight rail shipping depot in North Dakota last summer. And it's just staggering to see the sheer number of cars, many of which are heading from North Dakota east. They may be some of the very same cars that you're seeing. It's not just North Dakota. It could be Colorado, Texas, Oklahoma, other places as well. And there are a great many concerns, in part because to sustain rail operations along those long routes, many of which have not been expanded or maintained over time, for which inspection and safety monitoring is a real challenge and is an issue both for the firms and the various states that are involved. This is going to be a bigger and bigger issue, reflected, of course, then in the unfortunate derailments that you've had now just in the last couple of days in Wisconsin. So this is a significant issue. I do think the word moratorium was used, and that really does become a really intriguing question. If you shut down the rails as an option, and in fact there is strong pushback on pipelines, at least the short-term reality is that the commodity becomes much more scarce again. And with that, there's a substantial increase in prices. I did not think that I would ever be paying $1.95 for gas, but I did that in Virginia on a trip last weekend. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say if we start closing down shipping lanes, that means we're probably going back to a different level of cost for energy. And there could be environmental benefits for that. There could be technology benefits for that. But that's a conversation we've really not had as a country, and it's an interesting one to weigh and think about. Clearly, what we are beginning to see as pipeline and rail discussions emerge all across the country, that in general, Americans really like having access to oil and gas on a regular basis and like that cost to be as low as possible. The issue of how you either reduce risk or even eliminate it becomes another challenge because it directly relates to the accessibility of that product that we use all the time, and that's a huge challenge going forward.
As mentioned, there were two derailments of trains in Wisconsin over the weekend, one near Elma, which resulted in ethanol being spilled into the Mississippi River. The other was in Watertown, where 13 cars derailed, spilling crude oil and causing people in 35 homes to be evacuated. What needs, and we'll get an update on what's happening with those derailments and the cleanup with our environmental reporter coming up after the news. But Professor Rabe, what needs to be done to make rail transport safer?
Well, you know, you're right, and you've had two episodes now, one with biofuels, presumably from the Iowa region, the other crude, which probably comes from the Bakken. This reflects this sort of national trend and pattern. There are some things that can be done, some steps that are beginning to be taken. In some states, Pennsylvania is a good example, also Washington State, where there's a lot of this rail shipment. They have been expanding their inspection capacity. They are proposing actually putting a fee on trains in places like Washington and using that as a fund to cover some of the costs of inspection, safety evaluations, and the like. I know there has been a push by the federal government to try to make those rail cars, we've all seen them, more modern and safer. There are some things that can be done, but my understanding is that the crude car that tipped over, those were under the new safety standards, although fortunately there was no explosion there to my knowledge. So there are some interim steps that can be taken. There's also been discussion of actually putting on requirements for some of the firms that are producing this oil, especially in North Dakota, to try to take steps to change the chemical composition or volatility. So if there is an unfortunate accident, it's less likely to combust, to explode. And we've all seen, you know, photos of that. So there are some steps here, just like with pipeline safety. It does add a lot of expense. That's probably going to be borne by customers or taxpayers to some extent. Ultimately, it's going to be passed along in the price that you pay for the commodity at the pump. How far we're prepared to go to reduce that risk is not clear. And certainly in Congress, we've not had an extended discussion yet over how this would work. States can go so far, but this to some extent is an interstate issue because rail lines go across state and, of course, in the Canadian case, national borders. So I think we're going to be looking at some significant challenges here dealing with this, but the bottom line would be there is no mechanism to move oil and gas from point A to point B that is completely foolproof, that is completely safe, or is completely free of cost. To my knowledge, it just doesn't exist. And then you're weighing some of those trade-offs and questions and possibly seeing more of this transportation in the years ahead.
Yeah, and we have just 2 minutes, not even, before a news break and when we need to let you go. A caller who wants to say that he really believes that pipelines are more dangerous than a truck or rail because the oil spills by rail or truck have less impact. Can you give us a brief response to that?
You can certainly make that case, and having lived in a state that went through, as I mentioned, a horrible pipeline spill, there are all of those risks. I think the one thing that is thought to be somewhat safer in the pipeline issue is you simply don't have the above-ground movement of multiple rail cars and that issue in question. But are there risks of environmental degradation with both technologies? Yes. Much of the relative success of those technologies will not just be how they would operate in an abstract level, but how well they're managed, how well they're maintained, how closely they're monitored, what kind of inspections we have. In many of the large plain states, for example, there would be just a couple of inspectors for an entire state until very, very recently. It just wasn't an area that we were thinking much about. Who pays for that and how that is done is a really interesting challenge. Again, whether it's pipeline or rail, I don't want to minimize the possibilities, right, the possible risks of pipelines, but I think they're there in both of these cases.
Thank you very much for being with us. We'll check news, and then we'll get an update on the cleanup of those spills. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We will now get an update from our environmental reporter on the cleanup of two train derailments, one which was carrying crude oil. Two trains derailed in Wisconsin over the weekend. We will get updates and we'll welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Chuck Kornbach is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. He covered the weekend's train derailments in Alma and Watertown. Hello, Chuck.
Good morning.
Let's start with the situation in Watertown first, where 35 homes were evacuated on Sunday afternoon after 13 rail cars carrying crude oil derailed, causing a spill. People are being allowed home now?
Yeah, that's right. And Maureen mentioned that in the newscast a moment ago, that the people are back in their homes. About 35 had to leave. Others were certainly though worried throughout the neighborhood. We spoke to one activist who lives a few blocks away from the rail track Sunday night, and she described this loud sound, the concern in the community, and going to try to take pictures to document what was going on.
Yeah, and you reported in your initial story that the spill was no more than 500 gallons, though the exact volume wasn't known at that time. Do we have a clearer idea today?
I think that's still what the rail company and others are saying. They could have been much worse. Some of these 110-car trains, usually they're not all crude oil cars, but the long trains, as many people have seen, can carry over 1 million gallons or 2 million gallons of oil. So the fact that only 500 spilled or so was due maybe to what's being reported that these train cars on the oil train had been strengthened, had been upgraded somewhat to react to accidents.
So actually something was done to the cars themselves.
Yeah, they'd been reinforced, heat shields and other things. So whether that exactly helped, it is hard to say because the investigations are still ongoing, but it would seem that if you had upgraded a car and it didn't spill all that much compared to what it could have, that maybe that was a positive move.
So where did the oil go? Does it find its way into the water, or was it just pooled on the street, or what?
Well, I think that it didn't. There's less concern about Watertown, about the oil getting into the water, although it certainly could reach the groundwater. The fact that 500 gallons, you notice 500 milk jugs in your kitchen,
yeah.
But in the ground, it might have soaked in a bit, but I don't know yet whether it's reached the water table.
Yeah. Is there a specific cleanup efforts underway?
Yeah, the Canadian Pacific, owner of the train that derailed, has said that it uprighted 12, I think, of the cars that derailed and sent them on their way or took care of them. The 13th car, the oil has been offloaded, so to speak. The train car, I think, is going to be cut up or has been cut up and will be removed. So it's mostly done. There is some concern, though, about what got into the soil, at least.
Yeah. The other spill happened just north of Alma, along the Mississippi River, where an even larger amount of ethanol, 20,000 gallons, spilled into the Mississippi River. More than 100 people were evacuated, but they were allowed to return home that afternoon. The tracks were expected to reopen yesterday. Do you have the latest on the situation there?
I've not quite seen that, but I have seen, and maybe others have seen, video or aerial photos of the derailment. You know, these cars clinging barely to the ground and right up against the waterway is really dramatic visual there. These cars that derailed at Burlington Northern Santa Fe BNSF trains had not been reinforced, so there was more volume spillage, although ethanol was supposedly not quite as bad for the environment, although there's still concerns about fish kills for about the amount of ethanol that did get into the water.
Yeah, and the ethanol, there's really it just dissipates, or it's there's no way to remove it, right?
Well, I think it doesn't clump like crude oil does, and we've seen Exxon Valdez and other oil spills where there's been worry about oil getting into the sediment. The ethanol, yes, does dissipate, but it covers up, sucks up the oxygen
which leads to fish kills. And, you know, long, broader damage, hard to say. The Mississippi, obviously, a very big body of water, takes a lot of other pollutants in it. Whether this added a great deal of harm to the Mississippi, hard to say. But certainly in that local area where they can't recover the fuel because it's so mixed into the water, it's painful, at least for some wildlife, it seems.
Yeah. So do we have any idea of the environmental damage in Alma?
Well, our colleague Hope Kerwin in La Crosse is reporting the EPA is on the scene and, mm-hmm. and looking at that sort of thing. It's a little early to say. Monitoring takes place. Sometimes the bad things that happen take a while to develop, and so I'm sure we'll continue to watch.
Yeah, and is it safe to say that it could have been a whole lot worse in both of these cases?
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, as I say, the monitor oil that's carried in the train that went through Watertown, or typical trains like that, waterway spills along the Mississippi, dramatic, and has reinvigorated some political efforts on these fronts.
Yeah, the railroad companies involved, Canadian Pacific and Burlington Northern, are working with state and federal agencies. Are there any theories at this time as to what caused these accidents?
There are theories. There was a report that, at least in Watertown, there had been some track maintenance done near the site of the derailment. I would just caution speculation beyond that. But there are various theories out there. And I think ongoing media attention and certainly community attention, the people in Watertown, I think, want to know. The people near Alma and lovers of the Mississippi River want to know what happened. So I think there'll be ongoing insight in this.
What happens next in both Watertown or Alma?
Well, I think once we know the cause, once the reported cause is announced, I think that will spur more things. As I say, the politicians are ready to get going now with some additional action.
Yeah. Any thoughts as to whether Keystone or oil transport is going to be a topic in tonight's debate in Milwaukee, the GOP presidential debate that you'll be covering?
Well, it certainly could. These spills got national attention. Hopefully some of the moderators and question askers tonight will throw a question someone's way.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Chuck Kornbach is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. He covered this weekend's train derailments in Alma and in Watertown. 40 years ago this week, the SS Edmund Fitzgerald sank in Lake Superior, around 17 miles off the coast of Whitefish Point. All 29 crew members were lost, but their stories live on. As Danielle Kading reports, family members and historians gathered in Duluth this past weekend to share memories and lessons from the Edmund Fitzgerald's famous journey.
The SS Edmund Fitzgerald left Superior on November 9th for a steel mill in Detroit. The next morning, Jack Borgeson remembers his mother brushing his sister's hair in front of the TV when news came on of the ship's sinking.
In the moment, as I was arguing with my sister about one thing or another, we heard my mother scream, look of shock on her face, and she just said, you know, you lost your daddy.
His father was Thomas Dale Borgeson, a member of the Fitz maintenance crew. Pam Johnson also lost her father, Robert Rafferty, who was a fill-in cook. She remembers her father didn't want to go.
Actually, he asked to be taken off. Red Bergner was the cook on there for 10 years he'd been. And they called Red and said, would you like to come back? And he said, oh, no. He used other language and said, I'm not going back on there. I'm pulling rank. Rafferty's already on there. Let him finish it off. It's not that he wanted to. It was just he's making a living for his family.
Maritime historian and Fitz author Fred Stonehouse says sailing is just a job for many, like the ship's 29 crewmen, but a dangerous one at that. Stonehouse says 7,500 ships have sunk in the Great Lakes, taking 30,000 lives with them.
As we watch these vessels leave the harbor here and heading out through the canal, we need to recognize that. And it's not just when the gales in November are here. It literally is all of the time. The danger is always there, and fate is always the hunter.
A danger, Stonehouse says, Bernie Cooper was keenly aware of that night. Cooper was the captain of the SS Arthur M. Anderson, the last ship to have contact with the Fitzgerald and the first on the scene to search for survivors.
But when he told his crew, one of the assistant cooks came into the pilot house and said, Cap, are we really going to go? Yeah, but we're going to go. Well, I'll be back in 10 minutes. Fellow would come back 10 minutes later with a mayonnaise jar. And in that mayonnaise jar was a cassette tape. And there were 2,000 wraps of masking tape around that jar to make it waterproof. And he gave it to Cooper, and he said, Cap, if it looks like we're going down, would you throw this overboard? This is my last will. That was the thought that a lot of those guys had as Anderson went back out to look.
The Anderson wasn't the only ship to brave high winds and waves up to 30 feet or more. Historian and Great Lakes shipwreck diver Rick Mixter credits the crew of the Coast Guard vessel Woodrush for heading into the storm to rescue any survivors.
The people that boarded the Woodrush here to sail all the way across Lake Superior to pick up who could have survived that tragedy there. These people stand on guard today in airplanes and in ships. People that jump into that icy cold water to save them. I think more about those people who dedicate themselves to those that will protect those sailors that make those choices.
The first time Pam Johnson ever saw Lake Superior, she says she was impressed with its size and beauty and the connection she felt to her father.
He was just 17 miles away. People ask, how do I feel about seeing the lake? And I try not to go to an ugly place in my mind. I want to believe that my father is laying in his bed and he's all warm and the blankets are over him and he's with God now, and him sleeping in bed just makes it all right with me.
Now, 40 years later, the Edmund Fitzgerald remains a legend and a symbol of all the shipwrecks and crew members who have lost their lives on the Great Lakes. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Duluth.
Thanks to Bill Martins, to Chris Molina, and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is up next. He'll offer some rules of thumb on calculating when to retire, the right amount of college debt, and figuring out how much home you can afford. Tomorrow at this time, we will recap tonight's Republican presidential debate from Milwaukee. We'll talk with a guest political scientist about where the campaigns go from here. That's tomorrow from 7 until 8. Also tomorrow, which is Veterans Day, we will remember the Vietnam War era with music and with the authors of a new book exploring the way the war touched the music of its day. That's tomorrow from 8 until 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.